A soldier takes cover during the Battle of the Somme as shells are falling all around him. And suddenly his hand feels something metallic and he grabs it. And it's a silver cross. And another shell explodes and he buries his head in his hands. And then he feels someone jump into the trench with him. And he looks over and he sees it is an army chaplain. And the soldier thrusts the cross in the chaplain's face and he says, "I'm so glad to see you. How do you work this thing?" Well, in our text this evening, Jesus talks about taking up our cross. And maybe we can ask the same question. How do you work this thing? Someone else who doesn't know how to work with, how to deal with the cross is Simon Peter. I think it's fair to say in this passage that we see Simon Peter at his best. You are the Christ. And Simon Peter at his worst. No, Jesus, I'm afraid I have to rebuke you there. One person said that the only reason Simon Peter ever took his foot out of his mouth was to switch feet. But on this occasion, here in the Roman pagan stronghold of Caesarea Philippi, Simon Peter starts with that life-changing, that world-shattering statement we looked at last week that Mark places at the very center of his gospel, chapter 8, verse 29. Jesus asks his disciples for the latest opinion reports about himself. They say you're John the Baptist. They say you're one of the prophets. They say you're Elijah. Then comes the breathless silence as he puts forward to them, and by extension to us, that question of all questions. Who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? And suddenly Simon Peter realizes what he's known in his heart all along. He knows deep down and he says it. You are the Christ. You are the Christ. This is the Messiah in Hebrew, the Christ in Greek. That is the anointed one, the Son of God, the one who will redeem Israel. That's who Jesus is. That's what Mark's gospel has been leading up to all these weeks as we've been reading it in our evening series. That's the turning point of this whole story. From this point on, the whole of Mark's gospel focuses on Jesus going to Jerusalem. You are the Christ. You are the Christ. So Simon Peter's got it. He's got it. You are the Christ. He's got it. Or has he? Has he got it? You see, there is another question. Another question that he, and indeed we, must answer before we get it. And it is this. Jesus asking essentially, not just who do you say I am, but what have I come to do? What have I come to do? And because that question hasn't been addressed yet, no sooner has Simon Peter made this incredible statement, this proclamation that Jesus is the Christ, that Jesus says to him that he must tell no one. Verse 30. No one? Why? Why could he and the other disciples tell no one who Jesus was? Oh, that was why Jesus came. Because Jesus has to teach Peter and the disciples and to teach us about what he's come to do, what being the Messiah really means. As one person put it, and I hope this is a great challenge for us in our discipleship and in our evangelism, following Jesus is about more than simply getting his title right. following Jesus is about more than simply getting his title correct. Simon Peter gets it, but he doesn't get it. That's what Mark is trying to say. Actually, that's the teaching point of Jesus healing the blind man, verses 22 to 26, remember, in two attempts, not one. He gets it, but he doesn't get it. Mark is saying, just like Peter, the blind man saw something. Remember what he said? I see people. They look like trees walking round. He saw something, but he didn't see everything until Jesus put his hands on his eyes a second time. Simon Peter, he sees something. He sees the Messiah. He sees Jesus. But his idea of Messiah and Jesus' idea of Messiah, well, they're poles apart. He doesn't see everything. He doesn't see what Jesus wants him to see. In Peter's view, and in the view of his fellow Jews, they were all dreaming of the day when the Messiah would come to Israel. He would defeat the occupying forces, the Romans, and through a great military struggle would usher in a new golden age of peace and righteousness. God's kingdom would be restored that way. And from reading both the Old Testament prophets and the literature between the Old Testament and the New Testament, you can't blame most Jews in Jesus' time for thinking that way. After all, that is what is written. And you know, sometimes we may think that way too. It is what is written, but of course it's not all that is written. Sometimes you hear from preachers that every time in the Gospels you hear this phrase, Son of Man, used in verse 31, it only ever refers to Jesus as the fulfillment of the prophecy of Daniel chapter 7. The all-conquering Ancient of Days, if you remember, coming in his heavenly glory to restore Israel. That's the only Messiah there is, sometimes we're told. Whilst some references in the New Testament undeniably refer to this messianic figure of Daniel 7 in verse 31, we see a very different Messiah, don't we? The Son of Man not coming as an all-conquering military general. We see the Son of Man a suffering servant. A suffering servant. Now, the idea of Jesus, the Messiah, as a suffering Messiah, the idea that Jesus would be rejected, the idea that Jesus could even be killed, verse 31, was the complete opposite of what Simon Peter, what the disciples expected. It completely flies in the face of everything they knew. Imagine if next Sunday, Tim Welch stood up and he announced that we are now no longer a Baptist church, but we are now a Jewish synagogue. How would you feel? What would you think? Jesus as suffering Messiah was that foreign an idea to them. You can ask Tim afterwards whether he's got anything in the pipeline. So when Simon Peter hears this, what does he do? What does foot in his mouth Peter do? Verse 32. Well, he takes Jesus aside. He says, Jesus, Yeshua, can I have a quiet word? Listen, now, I know you're the Messiah and that, but stop it, will you? Stop it. Cut out all this stuff about suffering. You know, there's a time and a place for jokes, Jesus, but this, quite frankly, is neither. It's not funny. Well, what does Jesus do? Verse 33. He looks at all his disciples together and then referring to Simon Peter, his A-star pupil for his thesis on the identity of the Messiah, he exclaims, "Get behind me, Satan! You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Wow. What a jolt You know, whilst some churches, has to be said, mainly Roman Catholic churches, choose to inscribe on their buildings Jesus' praise of Peter from the parallel passage in Matthew 16, upon this rock I will build my church. That maybe the rock that Jesus meant was actually the confession, you are the Christ. I have to tell you, whilst I've seen those words inscribed on many different churches in brick, I've never seen these words a few lines later, again from Jesus to Peter, inscribed on a church. Get behind me, Satan. Can you imagine if you saw those words written in brick in a church building? Peter's got the wrong end of the stick. He hasn't got the Messiah he expected. I'm sure there's some of us here tonight who feel like we haven't met the Messiah we expected, that we haven't met the Messiah we wanted. And whilst we'd like to distance ourselves from Peter, I'd never do that. Don't we all, at least on some level, insist that Jesus must conform to our expectation of what the Messiah should and shouldn't do? It's Jesus on our terms, not Jesus on his. And through this passage, God is saying to us tonight, isn't he? See Jesus as he really is, not as we'd like to see him. And see discipleship, that key word in Mark, see discipleship as it really is, not as we'd like to see it. And so that we can see it, that's exactly why Jesus lays it out plainly as he can, as plainly as he can from verse 34. Let's read again from verse 34, the one verse that we're going to home in on this evening. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone will come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. So we've had, who do people say I am? We've had, what have I come to do? But now, finally, how can you follow me? What does it mean to follow Jesus? Jesus asking this question to us. How is it possible to follow him? What does it involve, following the Lord Jesus? Discipleship on his terms, not on ours. You see, when we accept the Messiah's free gift of forgiveness, and when he welcomes us with open arms, we are also accepting the burden of the cross. Take note of Jesus' first description of what it means to follow him. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Not an easy thing to hear, is it? Perhaps you know the story of two young brothers who come downstairs for breakfast on a Saturday morning, and there's their mum cooking pancakes. And she started to toss them when the boys start arguing about who's going to eat the first pancake. And their mother seizes this as a life lesson moment. And she says, now boys, what would Jesus say if he were here? And they stop and they look a little bit confused. And then their mother says, Jesus would say, my brother, you have the first pancake. I'll wait. And so the older brother, with a slight twinkle in his eye, he looks at the younger brother and he says, hey Josh, you be Jesus. Self-denial is not easy, is it? It's not. We all have things we want. We all have goals. But Jesus is clear. He's clear that when we choose to follow him, when we choose to accept his free gift of salvation, we must deny ourselves. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, salvation is free, but discipleship costs everything we have. Now, as you'll probably know, these are not ivory tower academics for Bonhoeffer. This is a man who paid the personal cost of discipleship when he was executed in 1945 for resisting the Nazis. On a radio broadcast in Berlin, Bonhoeffer had rebuked the German church for having allied with the Nazis, and he'd said, "There can be only one Führer, only one leader for Christians, and it isn't Adolf Hitler." Of course, the radio address was brought to an abrupt halt, something of a foreboding prologue of things to come. Here's what Bonhoeffer went on to write in his book, The Cost of Discipleship. He says, "To deny oneself is to be aware only of Christ and no more of self, to see only him who goes before and no more the road which is too hard for us. Once more, all that self-denial can say is, he leads the way, keep close to him." And friends, I think what Bonhoeffer means is this. Self-denial is not merely the denial of something to the self, like going without chocolate for 40 days over Lent. But self-denial is the denial of self itself. I wonder how you felt reading those words from Jesus. "If anyone will come after me, he or she must deny themselves." Whether we're here and we're not yet a Christian and still considering what it means, or whether we've thought of ourselves as a disciple of the Lord Jesus for a long time, what is God saying to you this evening through the verse 34? Certainly Jesus doesn't leave any room, does he, for armchair disciples. Whenever something gets too hard, whenever something hard comes along, one hand switches the channel to a different discipleship program, the other hand just takes another handful of crisps. Jesus says, deny yourself. These are hard-hitting words from the Messiah. Deny yourself. But Jesus also says, if anyone would come after me, he must take up his cross. He must take up his cross. In other words, we have to pick it up ourselves. Jesus didn't say grab hold of a cross for protection. He didn't say wear a cross as a fashion statement. He said take up your cross. This means that there is a choice. Jesus had a choice, didn't he? Jesus had a choice as to whether he was going to pick up his cross. He could have said no. And we have a choice. We have a choice whether to take up and bear our cross. What does it mean to bear your cross, to take up your cross? Let's first consider what bearing your cross is not. It is not the literal carrying a cross everywhere, like the now famous Arthur Blessett, the guy who carried a wooden crossbeam around the world for 45 years. It's not doing that. And it's not when people often say, "Oh, well, I guess that's the cross I have to bear," generally with a sort of, "Oh, pity me," kind of tone. Have you ever heard that before? That's not really bearing your cross, is it? That's working through unavoidable circumstances you'd just rather avoid. But taking up our cross is a choice. It is voluntary, sacrificial obedience that identifies us completely with Jesus Christ. Bearing our cross is not making the best out of a situation or circumstance. It is something we deliberately do, taking up our cross and bearing our cross for Jesus. Now, whilst we recognize that for Jewish messianic believers, the cross, the symbol of the cross, it may remind them of the persecution of the Jewish people. The swastika, after all, is a twisted cross. But for most of us here, I hope that when we see a cross, when we see the emblem of a cross, that we hold it special. Not because the New Testament tells us to, actually it doesn't, but just as a way, as a symbol of identifying with Jesus Christ. His suffering, and yes, our suffering. Now, I can't really understand why people who are not believers wear crosses around their neck. It would be a bit like wearing a gold chain on the end of which is an electric chair, a way of saying, you know, I want to die this way too. But whenever we see a cross, I hope it speaks to us of, first of all, Christ's determination to do his Father's will by dying for us at Calvary. That's what we're about to celebrate. And yes, it is a celebration at the Lord's table. As we come to communion, I hope that's what fills our minds. Christ's determination to do his Father's will. And I hope it speaks to us too of our determination, our choice, our determined choice to draw closer to Christ through what he's done and become more Christ-like, even though that it means suffering, even though that it may even mean death. But I hope it speaks to us ultimately of the resurrection, which of course we'll be thinking about more in our services in the lead up to Easter. Never has a symbol of such pain and a symbol of such torture been resurrected into a symbol of such unending love and a symbol of such unending hope. If anyone wants to be a true follower of the Lord Jesus Christ, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow him. So how is God challenging you this evening? How is he reminding you in your life of the cost of discipleship, of the taking up of our cross, of the denial of self? Whom among us is he calling this evening, perhaps for the first time, to take up their cross and to follow him, though it will cost us all we have? Earlier in the week, I read these words of Thomas A Kempis from the 15th century. Be challenged by them. Be challenged by them as I close and we celebrate the Lord's Supper. Jesus today has many who love his heavenly kingdom, but few who carry his cross. Many who yearn for comfort, few who long for distress. Plenty of people he finds to share his banquet, few to share his fast. Everyone desires to take part in his rejoicing, but few are willing to suffer anything for his sake. And apt as we come to communion, there are many that follow Jesus as far as the breaking of bread, few as far as drinking the cup of suffering. Many that revere his morality, few that follow him in the indignity of his cross. Well, maybe we be amongst the few that follow him in his indignity.